Welcome to the More Perfect Union Podcast, a regular discussion on the state of American politics and current events with entertaining and respectful commentary from across the political spectrum.
Welcome to the More Perfect Union, a podcast about the love and joy we all get from American politics. It's super fun. You can find us at moreperfectpodcast.com, facebook.com/moreperfectunionpodcast, and when you're on iTunes, a rate and a review goes a long way to spreading our message of love and bipartisanship throughout the internets. So I'm Jonah. I am briefly moderating this week. I am a personal trainer independent from the state of Maryland. Who else is here with me?
Well, I'm Kevin. I'm in Los Angeles. I'm a television writer, and I'm a Democrat, but on the more of the conservative side.
I'm DJ from Suffolk, Virginia, cost estimator and economics instructor, self-described economic conservative, self-confessed Republican.
And I'm Greg from Cincinnati, Ohio, stay-at-home dad and liberal Democrat.
Good. And longtime listeners that have been following us here to episode 6 from the beginning will notice that every once in a while, maybe someone comes in, someone comes out. We hope to keep that going, actually. But now we're going to get into our headlines. Kevin, I think you're up.
Right. So my headline this week appeared in The Guardian. The headline is Bill Maher pressures Bernie Sanders on how to pay for socialist measures. Bernie Sanders was on Bill Maher's HBO show Real Time with Bill Maher this week. And Maher, who is a supporter of Sanders, was trying to give him an opportunity to address the issue of socialism and what that label might mean in a general election should Bernie get the nomination. Now, to me, this is the key bridge that Bernie has to cross to become a viable national candidate. And the reason that I picked this particular headline is actually to talk about the interview itself. Maher gave him the opening, and I think Sanders whiffed on it. Sanders could not answer the question, what does it mean to be a democratic socialist, and how is that different from the socialism that we think of when we think of Cuba, when we think of some of these countries in the South America. And if Sanders can't come up with an adequate answer to defuse the charges that are going to be shot his way, that are already being shot his way by Donald Trump, that he's a communist, that socialism equates to communism, if he can't come up with an articulate answer that people can grasp and absorb and believe, I don't see any way that he can become a national candidate and win a national election. And I'm wondering what you guys think of that.
I mean, does anyone here actually think he's, I'm a liberal Democrat and I don't think he's actually a candidate. I mean, I think he's still just trying to move the conversation left until, I don't know, maybe the summer at some point.
Gee, respectfully, Greg, I disagree. I think he's in it to win it. Now, when he got in, he probably didn't harbor much hope of winning the nomination, but he's at between 33% and 40% in Iowa right now. And if you watched him at the JJ dinner, the Jefferson Jackson dinner last night, he looked like he was taking Hillary Clinton on head on. It didn't look to me like he was just there to espouse some passionate beliefs.
Exactly. When he's around Democrats and when he's around, he's the first one to get a little rough and tumble. But when he's on the national stage, it's hands off. It's kit and gloves. And it's, this is my good friend, and let's play nice. Because that's how you move on the primary. You know, that's been his MO from the beginning. No.
Well, first debate.
Right. On the national stage, he'll be very nice. And he's been doing this in all his speeches. Like, I'm pushing it. And he's been getting what he wants. He's not a real candidate. He's someone to move the conversation to the left, and that's great, and that's wonderful, and we appreciate Bernie. Not a real candidate, though. And once again, liberal Democrat, appreciate him. I'd shake his hand. I'd let him come over for dinner. Wouldn't vote for him.
I'd love to hear what our other colleagues think, because you and I are in sharp disagreement on that.
Yeah. Well, I'm actually in the middle of reading Charles Moore's authorized biography of Margaret Thatcher, and she actually went through and largely dismantled probably one of the last major genuine democratic socialist economies that are out there. Continental Europe has some bits of social democracy, some bits of corporate democracy, but really Britain, I think, probably came closest to it in the democratic world. And her famous phrase was, the problem with socialism is you eventually run out of other people's money. And that's exactly what Britain faced in the 1970s. And the irony is, Bernie may be one of the very few people who really remembers the 1970s, as he was an adult through it. Most voters these days don't. But I think that may have been partially what was holding him back, because he knew if he was going to try to say, well, you know, democratic socialism has been tried before, that would bring everyone back to where Britain was in the 1970s. And there are plenty of British across the political spectrum who will tell you that that's not where any democratic country wants to go.
Yeah. I think as an independent, one of my priorities is the rise of third parties, just organizations that can take it to Democrats and Republicans. 10 years ago, 12 years ago or something, we had a handful of Green Party people that were elected across the country. And for me, that was significant, and they didn't really hold it, and they're sort of gone. So for me, really, the best that Bernie Sanders can do, I guess, for me, in my big picture, is that he can articulately present the case of why democratic socialism should be thought of as mainstream as it can get. And I think he has sort of flashes there. But this Bill Maher's point is exactly right, that there has to be some glimpse of how this is realistic. And this, there were moments in the Democratic debate where I listened to Sanders speak and I thought, that's a good point. And there was a video package where he talked about why he was a democratic socialist. And I was like, okay, that makes sense. Maybe there's a touch of that could hit me now and then. But this idea of where the money comes from is significant. And so maybe Bernie Sanders can sort of articulate the overall view, and some economist can come along sometime and figure out where the money comes from. Maybe that's my best case scenario.
Okay. Well, some interesting divergence of opinion there. DJ, do you want to go to your headline?
Yes. Mine actually sort of makes Kevin's quasi-irrelevant, but that's okay. It was from Ramesh Panuru.
I like to feel that you do that all the time.
And he was actually talking about why Hillary Clinton is still the favorite to win the White House. I should note that he put this up on Wednesday. I think I saw it Thursday before the Benghazi testimony. Which is to say that I think before Thursday, Hillary did not look as strong as she did after Thursday. And we'll get into that later. But the key thing that Ramesh talked about was that he said that basically Republicans haven't done much to focus on middle class anxieties and giving the middle class a sense of economic security, which Democrats have been banging on now for about 5 or 10 years. And to me, it just really struck me because it's one of the things that I have noticed in my attempt, not only outside the party, but inside the party, not just to get them focused on limiting government size, scope, and cost, but also to remind people that government interventions can actually hurt middle class and poor Americans, and in many cases it does. If we did for Wall Street what we do for the average farmer and agribusiness, the price supports, the crop insurance, and all the various other nonsense, there would be marches in the street, and Bernie Sanders might actually get elected president of the United States. People would be so angry. But because it's farmers and it's out in rural America, and most of us just don't pay as much attention to it, and because these days rural America is heavily Republican, nobody seems to focus on it, and particularly folks in my party don't want to focus on it, even though it's probably has the greatest impact in raising the cost of living for middle-class Americans and poor Americans. We can talk about education reform dramatically, about the problems of the various local mini monopolies all throughout the country, and especially in our urban areas. But we don't talk about that as Republicans, and it's now gotten to the point where moderate Democrats like Ava Moskowitz and others in New York are pushing education reform. That should be really one of our issues as Republicans, but we just don't pick up that mantle as much as we should. We have been focused on what worked in the 1980s, and I'm a supply-sider, so I know why that worked, but we have not focused on how government policies hurt the middle class and hurt the poor and show the American people that we're willing to reverse that and do the hard things necessary to stop that from happening. And until we're willing to do that, we really don't have much to say to the middle class and poor Americans. And because of that, we're going to keep putting ourselves behind the eight ball every 4th November.
Well, it's an interesting article and an interesting argument that you're making. You know, for me, again, coming to it from the Democratic side and someone who does not believe in supply-side economics, I would disagree with your premise that it worked in the 80s, but I think that that's a whole argument that we could have throughout another show. I'd like to ask you, though, DJ, you say they don't make the argument. They make the argument. They articulate it, but they don't seem to prove that their theories work. How could they prove that their theories work?
Well, if you're refer – well, I think the – well, let me take a step back. Which theories are you referring to? That may help me out just a little.
The Republican theory is a basic, you know, national economics, supply-side economics.
Okay, I got you.
Deficit.
I understand now. I know what you're talking about. Yeah. Now, those are things where we can – I mean, you know, you're right. We could argue about the 1980s for years, but the reason I brought that up was because one of the things about supply side economics is it is very clear that when done a certain way, the direct impact is first felt by the wealthiest Americans. We as Republicans don't talk about policies or fixing policies or reversing policies where middle class and lower class Americans can directly benefit. And there's a bunch of them. We can and I think should expand the earned income tax credit. We need to take a hard look at the pitchfork corporatism and the agricultural subsidies and things of that nature. We need to look at education reform. The reason I brought up supply side economics is because it is over 30 years old and we're still talking about it. Some voters understood in the 1980s that was good for them, that it wasn't good for them. But also those who sold it, particularly from Ronald Reagan on down, sold it as something that helped the middle class. Republicans as a whole aren't really talking to the middle class. And that was the point I was trying to make, and that was the point Ramesh was trying to make. As to whether or not supply-side economics work or they don't, again, you're right. We could argue about that for a while. But we also have to realize that supply-side economics is more than just – cutting the top tax rate for wealthier Americans. There's a lot more to supply side economics. And frankly, Republicans don't talk about that either, and that doesn't help them any better. There are things about dealing with regulations and various other things that are costs to businesses that make it harder for businesses to produce and make it harder for them to pay their workers because they're dealing with other costs out there. We don't talk about those either. I guess the point I'm trying to make is Republicans, I think, have some messages they can bring to the American people. For whatever reason, they're choosing not to do it. And as a Republican, it's frustrating.
Okay, well, we could go on this for a while, but I won't. Who's up next?
So my article this week is picked at the last moment, was from the New York Times. I love the Times. And it's from their op-ed. And they picked, we've been talking about this a lot, Rubio as their front runner. And they said a couple strange things. One, not that Rubio is their front runner, because like I said, we've been saying that for the past 4 weeks. I think the majority of us have all agreed. But one, they said that this has been a really strong group for the GOP, which I don't know about that. But two, then in one paragraph, they just chopped them all down. Carson, no. Trump, no. Fiona, no. Kasich, too moderate and too ornery. Chris Christie, nope. Dumpum, Scott Walk, nope. Gone, gone, gone. Ted Cruz, nope. Boom, boom, boom. And the only ones that they actually thought had a chance, Jeb, !, and Marco Rubio. And he said, but Jeb doesn't have it. Rubio does. And it goes on to say, Rubio is the guy. Rubio is, you know, the man to beat this year. And, you know, whether he can do it or not. But the best part I loved about it was, but in the end, Mitt Romney might come back. They're the one that he's still ready to serve.
So Chuck Todd was putting that forth today on Meet the Press.
Oh, I saw that too. That's the other part. That's where I couldn't remember where else I heard it. Which, how desperate are these people that they're still, everyone is still talking about Romney. But,
if anybody genuinely thinks that Trump and Carson voters are going to somehow be won over and convinced by the return of Mitt Romney, they really don't understand what my party is going through right now. It's just not happening.
Well,
okay?
Actually, I don't think that the premise is that those people will be won over by them. I think the premise is that the so-called establishment needs a candidate that they can rally around. And if it can't be Rubio and it can't be Bush, that Romney might be the person that could take that 60% of the party and turn it into a nomination.
Are we looking at a brokered convention, do you think?
I think the first thing we'll have to figure out is what happens after New Hampshire, because it was something that none of us picked upon. But on Friday, the Bush campaign had a memo that leaked, or they themselves leaked a memo that basically said, we're cutting back on staff, we're cutting back on consultants, and we're going all in on New Hampshire. So I think they are really deciding that if they don't, they either have to make a strong showing in New Hampshire or they're pretty much done. And I'm not sure I'm necessarily going to see that in New Hampshire. Excuse me, in New Hampshire. Now I get the hiccups. Wonderful. But to make a long story short, the reason neither Rubio nor Bush can break out as the establishment choice, if you will, is because they're both still in the race. And this is going to be one where either the establishment figures themselves, the elected officials, or, you know, or the donors, whoever they are going to have to huddle with Rubio or huddle with Bush and tell them, look, one of you has to go. And at this point, you know, Rubio is the one who has recovered in Iowa. Bush is not. Neither of them seem to be doing much of anything up in New Hampshire, despite Bush putting in, like I said, going all in up there. And there's now stuff from, you know, the what I would call the crazy press saying that Bush is going to drop out tomorrow. It's not going to happen, mind you.
Oh, no.
But the fact that those rumors are surrounding him basically says that he is the weaker of the two. And if this continues, and I suspect it will, I don't actually see Bush. To be honest, I think Bush could drop out before the end of the calendar year. And I think he will certainly drop out after New Hampshire, because I don't see him doing what he needs to do there. And once that happens, then it can be everybody. It would, I guess, be everybody behind Marco Rubio. But Mitt Romney, frankly, Mitt Romney lost the election. And there are a lot of people in the party who still really cannot believe that Romney lost that election. There are certain fundamentals that they don't really fully understand, I don't think. And their basic attitude is, look, if he can't win against an incumbent that had as much problems as Barack Obama did, he's not going to be able to do it against Hillary Clinton, who will not be an incumbent and who will be a little harder to pin down on the Obama administration record, and who will have, you know, the historical thing behind her that Obama did not have because he was running for re-election. So, you know, I think there are a lot of people in the party who look at Mitt Romney and just go, no, we've tried this before. It did not work. We're not going to try it again.
So the other big question, though, will Rubio ever get the Trump Carson vote? I mean, I don't want to call them crazies, but the non-government crazies. Sure, why not?
Well, he has. From what I've seen in the when I look at the favorability unfavorability comparisons, Rubio usually has among the highest favorabilities and among the lowest unfavorabilities.
Sure.
So I think he's in a position where he would be able to win some of those people over. There are going to be some immigration hardliners that he will never win over, but, you know, we knew that going in.
Oh, sure.
But I think for the most part, I would say most of the people who are saying they're voting for Trump and Carson right now, I think a lot of them would be able to vote. I think a lot of them would vote for Rubio in a general election. And I still think a lot of them may end up voting for Rubio during the nomination contest if one or both of them start to, you know, start to let a little air out of the balloon as Trump seems to be doing in Iowa right now.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I could certainly see Carson voters, you know, shifting to Rubio. Trump voters, it's hard to pin them down, but I don't see them as a Trump or nobody kind of voters. I think that they would, you know, very easily shift to someone who, you know, can articulate an outsider message. They may be disappointed, but it's not going to be like Sanders voters who might not vote for Clinton if she gets the nomination because they'll be so disillusioned.
Oh, I don't know. I spoke to a Trump voter this week, and the message they told me literally was, I will not vote for anybody who's ever held public office. And I said, well, that's ridiculous. Why would you want to? I said, would you go to a doctor who's never been to medical school or who's never held a scalpel? And he said, well, that's different. I said, or would you go to a banker who's never, you know, made a transaction? He said, well, that's different. Or a mechanic. I went on. I had a lot of analogies. I was really into it. But I said, why would you vote for a president who's never held an office? They tell the truth. What? I was like,
oh, it's hysterical. It's hysterical.
It is. You know.
Again, that, and that shows the difference between those of us in, from the Northeast who've seen this shtick before and who can't put Trump and truth in the same sentence for obvious reasons, even if they even if the two words share three letters, and people from outside the Northeast for whom this is really the first time they've seen him and it sounds good to them. And they have no idea how many times he has, and how many times he's lied through his teeth, which he did all throughout the 1980s and 90s. So,
all right, Jonah, what do you have for us?
Yeah. So my headline is: aging Supreme Court energizes Republicans more than Democrats in the 2016 race. This is from USA Today. I'm a sucker for a good Supreme Court story. So this is. This one's nice. There are a couple of neat little trivia pieces in here. By next July, there are going to be three justices that are 80 or older. They're in the last 16 Supreme Court nominations, 12 have been made by Republicans, and yet they've never really gotten the control that they've wanted to get. And that's all interesting. Good stuff for trivia. But what they're talking about with the headline of energizing Republicans more than Democrats doesn't mean voters. At least they didn't have any evidence of that in the article. What they were sort of tapped into about halfway through was this idea that if a Democrat wins the presidency and then has a couple of Supreme Court nominations to in their term, that the idea of this article is that the Republicans in the House are pretty likely to just not let any of them go through and to leave empty seats on the Supreme Court until there's a Republican in the White House.
Wait. Are you saying Republicans in the House would be belligerent, combative, and standoffish for partisan reasons?
I think it goes back a little bit. Like, if we want to go to Bork, that's fine. But I think that whatever the tradition we have now with getting justices on the bench is just getting worse and worse. Now, whether or not this would actually happen and whether or not, you know, one Supreme Court justice retires and then there's one empty seat and then a second one dies because they're 82 and then there's another empty seat. The idea that I can sort of see this playing out because we have so many empty seats on the bench around the country that have just not gotten through. There are still secretaries and leaders of various agencies that have not been approved because Obama's in the White House and the people who love freedom run the Congress. So this is the position that we're in.
Yeah, wait, I want to understand. You're not talking about from now until the election. You're talking about what if a Hillary Clinton or a Bernie Sanders is elected president?
Yes.
That they would let 4 years go by without filling these nominations?
So that's the idea here. That's the idea halfway through this article.
I have a question for everyone here.
Yeah.
Who among you has ever come across the name Miguel Estrada?
Didn't he play shortstop for the A's?
I didn't think so.
No, I'm joking.
No. funny. Miguel Estrada was an appeals court nominee from George W. Bush, appointed in 2001. The Democrats in the United States Senate filibustered his nomination for 6 years. He actually just gave up in 2006 and said, "Forget it. I know they'll never let me sit on the bench, so I'm not bothering." This is not something that popped up in 2008. This has predated it. And in fact, there was talk in 2005, 2006 about creating what was called the nuclear option, of just ending the filibuster, just so that Democrats would not be able to block those just judges from being filled. And it wasn't just Estrada. There were a couple of others, but Estrada was the most egregious example. Now, this is not something that is good on either side. And I think what will probably happen is you would likely see something where the filibuster is just blown up for judicial nominees. It may have already happened. I thought Harry Reid did that already last year. But if you have a president of one party and a Senate of another party, then this is something that, again, has gone back to Bork and even before then. You end up with, you know, presidents playing games with certain lawyers and certain judges to try to get them on. And this is something that, I mean, if I would suspect, based on the composition of this, if the Republicans hold the Senate in 2016, even with Hillary winning, and I'm not necessarily sure that would happen, you're probably going to get about half a dozen to a dozen senators of the Orrin Hatch type who would be of the opinion that, you know, hey, they won the presidential election, we need to defer to them on judges and justices. You're right. This started with the whole Robert Bork thing, and it led to an empty seat on the court for about 2 or 3 months, and there were a number of decisions that were, in fact, 4-4 as a result. But I don't think it will get that bad, because the Republicans would have to be at about 60 seats to have the 51 who would block anything and keep a seat open, and I don't see them getting the 60 seats. I'm not even sure they'd keep 50 if Mrs. Clinton gets elected. And this is not something that the Republicans alone are guilty of doing. The Democrats have done this too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Democrats can be dicks too. The nuclear option did go through in 2013.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's a majority.
Right. So it would have to be 51. And I don't think – right. And I don't think the – if Mrs. Clinton is elected next year, and I still think she's the favorite – the Republicans would have to get up to 60 seats just to have the 51 or so to permanently block a justice from getting confirmed. And again, I'm not even sure they'd get to 51, let alone 60. So I think this is, you know, it's an interesting discussion. It says something about the polarization of our politics. Yes, it does. But I don't see it as a realistic scenario in 2017 and 2018.
Right. And additionally, like, some of those justices, like Scalia, he's been living without like an actual human heart for years. I mean, he's like, whether through voodoo or just pure evilness. So I think most of those judges can live for another 100, 200 years. So you got that going too.
You know, it's funny, but the irony is that, you know, these people have a job that many people live into their late 80s and 90s doing. They do seem like the older judges, aside from Ginsburg, do seem to be rather robust. Uh-huh. And it's very possible that we could go through an entire administration with one or maybe even no appointments open.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Sure.
I think you would in the case of Scalia and probably Thomas, these are two people who would like to find a way to stay on the bench after their physical bodies expire, knowing the two of them as they do.
Like robot yeah, Scalia,
something like that. You know, there may be something. You know, one of them may actually be trying to create an umbrella corporation and figure, hey, if I get the T virus, I mean, I know what the hell I'm doing, but at least I'll be here for a while. I think it is highly. We may not get a vacancy over the next few years.
I don't know. Three of them, 80 years old. I don't know. Odds are with at least one, I think.
Well, now I know what I'm going for Halloween as. Zombie Scalia.
So let me ask you guys this. We'll get out of our headlines and into the main subject here. Let me ask this. What the hell happened in Benghazi?
Wait, in Benghazi or in the committee hearing?
At this point, either or.
There's a huge difference.
Yeah. So we had our committee hearing this week, and this is I think the big news, right? This is the big news of the week.
Let me clarify. We had our eighth. We had one of our eighth committee hearings. So let's be clear on that. It wasn't the first one. It was the eighth one.
Right. Hillary Clinton testified for up to 11 hours, although there were breaks. But she testified all day long on Thursday. And it seems to be general consensus that she did extremely well and that the Republicans on the committee hurt their case more than they helped it.
Right. CNN released a poll Friday that 3 out of 4 people now believe that the entire Benghazi hearings are ridiculously partisan. I don't think that was the exact phrase, but that it was a partisan ploy to begin with. So,
yeah.
But it's CNN too, so let's keep that in mind.
So the question is, I mean, I don't know that there's much to discuss in terms of how the committee hearing went. I think probably I think the world is in general agreement. She looked very presidential. Even Bob Woodward used those words. Excuse me, Carl Bernstein used those words. And the Republicans did not nail her down on anything too specific. The question is, what happens to the issue now? Does the issue go away, or do they regroup and find new red meat to throw to the conservative base?
So here's my sense. I'm going to go back to Lindsey Graham on this. I've always sort of had an open mind about this last Benghazi hearing, in part because people like Lindsey Graham, who I respect, seems to me to be kind of a pretty dedicated, smart thinker about foreign policy, had always sort of said, well, we have these lingering questions. And when I hear somebody like Lindsey Graham say that, then I say, oh, yeah, okay, let's get these lingering questions out there and ask them. And I went to this hearing thinking these lingering questions are going to be asked, and now is the time when I will see if there are actually legitimate lingering questions still out there. And near as I can tell, if there are any, nobody thought to bring them up. Because it seems like, you know, aside from look at this stack of email, look at that stack of email, let's talk about Sidney Blumenthal, let's talk about what, like, it didn't seem to me, as the guy who was like waiting, okay, you have your chance, ask the question. You're saying there are these questions. You're saying that these things need to be answered. Ask them. And they weren't asked, which to me tells me they don't actually exist. I am not a big fan of Hillary Clinton, but I left this at least taking a half a step towards her crazy idea of big conservative Republican conspiracy against the Clintons. I'm like, okay, in this case, I think I agree with you on that. Now let's just stop talking about it and move on.
I want to jump in on one. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Kev. No, you go ahead. I'm being patient here.
Okay. I can't do that. You guys know it. There's one issue that came up that everybody thought might be a smoking gun, and it was the two emails that Hillary Clinton sent the night of the attack, I think from her home, one to her daughter Chelsea and another one to, I think, the president of Egypt or whoever is running Egypt, that seemed to suggest that she was saying that she thought an Al-Qaeda-like group was behind the attack. Now, here's a question that no one has said on any of the cable networks. You will hear it here first. And to me, this is kind of almost the heart of why that's such a non-issue. As you guys know, Hillary Clinton felt that it was her responsibility to turn over all of her work-related emails and that her personal emails were hers to keep or destroy. And she has said very vocally many times that she attempted to destroy all of her personal emails. So my question is this. If Hillary Clinton sent an email to Chelsea Clinton, which is clearly personal, and she did not destroy it, doesn't that mean that even she didn't think there was anything wrong with the content of that email, that even she interpreted it differently than the committee wants the general public to interpret it? Does that make sense? Or should I have just shut up?
No,
it's fine.
No, I see. It was my understanding she didn't go through the emails. It was
no, but her people went through it. But the point is, that's clearly an email from Hillary to Chelsea and Bill about what happened that day is not a work email, and yet she kept it and submitted it to the committee. So she wouldn't have done that if she thought there was some smoking gun in the email.
I think the part of this that will remain in the 2016 campaign has been largely – it hasn't been talked about very much for obvious reasons, because whenever you have something like this, you can pretty much guarantee that the witness is always going to win. People treat congressional committee testimony like trial testimony. It's not like trial testimony. There's no Perry Mason moment. There's no real gotcha questions, and there's always a chance for the witness to basically turn on whoever's questioning them and score some points. Oliver North did it in 1987. Heck, Ken Starr played off some Democrats who were upset at him during the 1998 impeachment hearings, and he actually got impeachment through Congress that way. So I'm not really surprised that Hillary was able to basically play off the Republican question, the questioning. That doesn't really surprise me. In fact, Trey Gowdy actually gave her the option of doing a closed session for her testimony, and she said, no, I want it out there and I want it in public for obvious reasons. She knew that she would be better at this. But there was one thing that really has been talked about, and that was Ambassador Stevens' emails, because despite repeated requests for them, the committee actually got them on Tuesday. One of them was that the ambassador made hundreds of requests for increased security. And these, not only were they not accepted or agreed to, they never even made it to the secretary for her consideration, despite everything that was going on. And this tells me something that is very, very problematic, is that this isn't Liechtenstein, this isn't Lesotho, this is Libya, the one country on the planet where this administration engaged in a successful regime change. You would think the ambassador to this country would have a direct line to the secretary and quite possibly a direct line to the president. Unfortunately, what this shows us is that this administration looked at Libya, said, you know, Gaddafi's out, we've checked the box, and we've moved on. And that complacency and, frankly, that incompetence allowed al-Qaeda to get a stronghold in North Africa, allowed it to rebuild and strengthen itself to where it's now on the move again as far out as Afghanistan. And what has happened with this is that Benghazi was not the start of an administration problem. It wasn't the start of an issue. It was the symptom of this administration's complacency and incompetence in North Africa. And that is something for which the secretary, as the lead foreign policy officer, is personally responsible. And that is something that she will have to address in 2016, because in my opinion, that is a much more important disqualification for her to become president than anything she said as first lady that got Jonah upset in 1993, which you talked about on the first episode of this podcast. When you foul up this badly at your job, you don't get a promotion. And that's what I think is the issue. Not what she did in those first hours after the attack, what she said in the first days after the attack. No, it's what this administration, of which she was a part, did between the removal of Gaddafi and the attack itself, and then further on. It was a policy error, a dramatic policy error. And that is what should, I'm not saying it will because we're the stupid party, mind you, but that's what should be the issue in 2016. And of course, nobody on the committee mentioned that because they're all idiots.
Well, I have to jump in, and very respectfully, because I do really respect your opinion, DJ, but on this one, I have to strongly take the other side. First of all, it sounds more like you're a member of the committee now than somebody objectively looking at the process. You know, when the FBI in 2001, we had people in the FBI sending memos saying, hey, there's this guy, Zachary Moussaoui, whatever his name was, who's taking flying lessons and doesn't seem to want to land. We're a little concerned that he might want to fly a plane into a building. Those messages never got to the right people either. Sometimes it's just a screw-up in internal communication between different departments or even within one department. Information that should have gotten to the right place doesn't. It's not a policy screw-up. It's not that they looked at Libya and said, been there, done that, we don't care anymore. It was just a human error. You're looking for some type of, you know, black helicopter conspiracy or massive example of incompetence that's just not there. Should those communiques have gotten to the right place? Of course they should have. But you know, this stuff happens in government all the time. And the idea that that somehow is a disqualifying of Hillary Clinton to be commander in chief, I'm sorry, that just doesn't pass muster with me.
If you make a mistake this dramatic, when your allies who helped you get rid of Gaddafi are actually pulling out of the country entirely because they see the situation is really messed up, if you're telling me that the ambassador's viewpoint is not even getting to the policymakers, that doesn't mean that they're deliberately ignoring him. What it means is they did not place Libya as a priority after they removed Gaddafi. That is a very serious policy error. They did everything that the Democrats accused Bush of doing in Iraq after 2003, and rightly so, because they were right. He took his eye off the ball too that year, and he took the eye off the ball to someone in Afghanistan as well after 2002. This administration did the same thing in Libya after 2011. They took their eye off the ball. And that's a problem. That's a problem for the president, although he's not up for re-election again. And that's a problem for his chief foreign policy official at the time, who helped orchestrate the policy, or in this case, a lack of policy. And that's her. I'm not saying she did anything criminal. I don't think she did. At least not regards to this. What I'm saying is, as the British would like to say, it was worse than a crime. It was a blunder. And I think that blunder a serious problem for her.
It was a terrorist attack, and sometimes as vigilant as you are, they're still going to happen. But maybe we should move on now because we haven't even touched on the Republicans other than talking a little bit about – well, actually, we have talked about the Republicans, but I don't want this to become a debate just between the two of us on one subject.
Yeah, actually, we should probably move on to – there's something – one of my favorite stories is Paul Ryan has finally agreed to – the speaker to run for speaker, but he's of course made demands to run for speaker of his own after the demands from the other. It's very demandy. I don't know if you guys have seen all the demands. It's one of my favorite stories. Has anyone else been following this?
I have been following this. Yeah. He made probably the one that got people on the Freedom Caucus side the most upset was when he said to get rid of the potential to move to vacate the chair, which apparently was something that goes back to the days of Jefferson. I don't remember going back that far.
Yeah.
But he did whatever it was. We know he got at least 2/3 of the House Freedom Caucus to back him, which pretty much means this is a done deal. He's gonna run. He has actually already said he's gonna run. He's gonna get the party's gonna choose him on the 28th on Thursday. He's going to be elected by the floor on Friday, and then he has 2 or 3 days to figure out the whole debt ceiling thing. Welcome to your new job, Paul.
It's welcome to your new job. But career-wise, is this it for him? I mean, yes, Speaker of the House. I mean, he's peaked now at this point. I mean, there's almost no chance he'll ever run for president after this, right?
Well, there is one possibility, which is that he just fills the seat for the remainder of this Congress and then doesn't run again.
Yeah,
I think that's what,
yeah, I
think that's what,
I guess
he,
it,
that's what he wants. If, I think that is exactly what he wants.
Yeah, if he starts off his first press conference and says, you know, I'm just serving in an interim capacity until somebody else comes along, and he just hits that over and over again, whether it'll work, I don't know.
Right. He is Cincinnatus.
Or Larry Lessig. One of those two.
But I think, you know, making all those demands, like, that's smart. Like, they need to do that because, as we've talked about and smarter people than us have talked about, you know, nobody wants that job. That's a suck job right now. And in order for him to do it, he has to get people to agree in advance to leave him alone and let him do the job.
Yeah, but who's made it a suck job?
Oh, the Freedom Caucus.
Thank you. Your own party has made it a suck job.
I don't like calling them Republicans. They're something.
It's.
Look, hey, you know, hey.
I know.
My name is Paul, and that's between y'all. But.
One of the biggest, there are probably two problems that Ryan is going to face as he actually goes forward with this. The first one is, of course, that he's dealing with a House majority. Any House majority is a lot like herding cats, and he's now going to have to be responsible for herding the cats. The other thing is I'm trying to be fair to say this. The last time the president of the United States actually talked about negotiating with Congress on anything, he sat the Republicans down. It was right after the 2014 election, and demanded that they give him an immigration bill he wanted before they actually were to take power in 2015. So he's sitting there yelling at Mitch McConnell, well, not yelling, demanding that Mitch McConnell provide something that he can't do because he was still in the Senate minority until January 3rd, 2015. There are a lot of people on my side of the aisle who frankly don't trust the president, who frankly think he does not like us, who frankly think he doesn't negotiate in good faith. Now, there are probably plenty of you on the other side who think that Boehner and McConnell at all don't negotiate in good faith either. And frankly, a lot of us would agree with you because they don't negotiate with parts of their party in good faith. And that's really, I think, the biggest problem is that there's distrust between the parties and there's distrust within the parties. And I don't know if that's necessarily something that Paul Ryan can fix. It may very well be that things just sort of hobble along until the voters decide this one way or the other. I mean, we had this back and forth, these arguments, this brinksmanship. We had it all over 2011, 2012, and the American people basically said, you know what? We really hate the way you did that and argued at each other. We're going to put you all back in power to do it again. What? The American people have to make a decision here. They have to go one way or they have to go the other way. Right. They can't do the split decision thing or we're going to keep doing this over and over and over again.
Right.
Pick one.
House of Congress has a 97% incumbency rate. You know, and it's difficult. It's easy to say, well, I hate those bozos up in Congress, but your local guy, well, that's your guy. It's like, oh, this guy I like because he's me. He's my guy. But all those other guys, oh, those guys are just – those guys are assholes. This guy's my guy. In fact, and to add to that, they just announced who's running against Jordan in Ohio. It's a former elementary school teacher. That's it. That's our best. She's a 61-year-old elementary school teacher. Okay, and I'm a Democrat, and I'm like, oh, I'm a former teacher, and I'm like, ta da, that's our A team. Okay, we're going to beat our Freedom Caucus. Yep, turn the lights off as we leave. Congratulations. Yeah.
Well, we will see what happens in 2016. But again, I think the big thing is this is one where the American people have to act. Again, they have to make a decision one way or the other. They can't play this split game. And I've seen, you know, even in the 21st century, I've seen shifts of 20 to 25 seats. And it would only take a shift of 30 seats to put the Democrats back in charge of the House of Representatives. And sure, if it's going to be a 51-49 election, that's hard to see happening. But if Mrs. Clinton, and again, I'm assuming she's a nominee, if she can get it to 53%, if she can get it to 54%, then it's an entirely different game. And frankly, it's up to the Democrats to see if they can convince enough Americans to go in that direction.
Well, she's got the nomination, the endorsements, and AFSCME just endorsed her. And I don't know if you guys have been watching, but Katy Perry took over her Instagram account today.
No, I didn't see that.
Oh, it's in the bag now.
Oh, it's in the bag. And the pictures of Katy Perry meeting Bill, or vice versa, however, are awesome.
That will go a lot farther with voters than any of us want to acknowledge.
That's why I'm saying.
It's such an uncomfortable image.
But to
get back to talking about endorsements, obviously political endorsements are going to flood to her. An interesting one came out just, I think, this morning that David Plouffe, who was, of course, the architect of President Obama's first and second successful campaigns, he endorsed Hillary Clinton today, too. And I think that that says something. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've been watching MSNBC, you know that David Axelrod essentially has endorsed her, although he hasn't said those words. But he believes that she's the stronger candidate to run in the fall. Now you've got David Plouffe saying the same thing officially, which I think tells you a lot about where President Obama's mind probably is on this. I think the Democrats are going to unite behind her in a big way. I think she is going to be a very formidable candidate.
Oh yeah.
Once Biden chose not to run, that essentially made that turned Mrs. Clinton from Obama's biggest rival in the party to his heir within the party, and that basically means yes, the administration will pretty much fall in line behind her, and yes, it means going to have a very united party behind her, no doubt. It's why she's still the favorite next year.
Right. Bernie Sanders has Bill Maher endorsing him and Billy Bragg. So, I mean, and only one of them can vote in this election.
In our remaining minutes, should we give a little bit more time to the Republicans? They have a big debate coming up next this coming Wednesday. I think it's their third outing on the big stage.
Oh, yeah. I'm excited about it. Are they all on the same stage at this point? Or?
Oh, no. No, no.
Well, nobody's dropped out yet, right?
There's still going to be an undercard of some way, shape, or form.
Well, Rick Perry's dropped out. Jeb has dropped out, according to every – oh, wait. No, he hasn't.
No, he hasn't.
It just seems like he has.
But you still have Pataki. You still have Graham. You still have Jim Gilmore, Jindal.
Okay, how Jindal is still in it is mind-boggling. I mean,
well, yeah. Here's a question, Greg.
Sure.
What has he actually done that costs money? He's got no ads. He's not campaigning anywhere. He's still around. He pops up on a debate every now and then, and he issues a press release.
I actually
you could
see
go pretty
him
well with not a lot with a little money on that.
In the back of my mind, I see him like working in like a silk screening shirt back, like when he's just like, hey, this T-shirt looks pretty good. I bet I could make a dozen before I have to go home tonight. Okay, and doing another just to save money.
I wonder if some of these guys are waiting like we all are, like they're like the Jindal and Pataki, like they don't want to endorse Trump. So they're waiting for like, is it going to be Rubio? Can we just say it's going to be Rubio so I can drop out and endorse Rubio? Like, I wonder if there's a little bit of that going on. Like, it's not going to be Carson. It's not going to be Trump. I just need to know who it is. And I can't quit until then.
No, because they don't have to endorse when they drop out. I think it's just the opposite. I think that these guys should drop out so that, you know, the anti-Trump vote can coalesce around someone hopefully other than Ben Carson. But it's all ego. I mean, what does Bobby Jindal have to go home to?
Well,
what does
George
Pataki have to go home to?
Right. So Jindal, you know, it's too term limited for governor, so he can't run for re-election. So exactly the question is what you just asked, what's he got to go home to? And that's nothing. So he's got to wait and endorse somebody and then work for them to get a job, right?
Okay, I'm going to interrupt. His wife and kids listen to our podcast and are really hurt by your last comments.
They
are crushed.
The presence of so many candidates still in the race, whether it's Vanity Project or anything else, it just exemplifies how weak the Republican establishment really is and how discredited it is. Otherwise, it could have corralled about half the field out of the race. It can't do that because it doesn't have the strength, and because for a lot of Republican voters, these are the same clowns who inflicted George W. Bush on us, who have lost the last
two presidential elections. And so when they talk about, oh, we need to do this, we need to do that, most of us as Republicans look at them like, no, actually, you just need to go away because you're a bunch of morons. And well, that's what's being reflected in all these candidates running.
You're right, and it speaks to the weakness of a single individual, Rance Priebus, and whoever it is that works with him at the RNC. And, you know, a couple of weeks ago, there was so much discussion about Debbie Wasserman Schultz and how she was such a dictator and she was taking, you know, control of the democratic process. Well, somebody had to have some balls, and it looks to me like on the Republican side, no one has the cojones to tell these people, look, you're not going to be president. It's time to go home. You know what they could do? They could say you have to have a 5% or better, you know, polling of, you know, an average of 8 polls. You have to be at least, even if they just set it at 2%, it would cut down the number of people to under 10. But no one will do that. No one will take control of their own party. And I think that speaks to a big problem in that party, even more so than the Freedom Caucus.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's right, and that's exactly right. No one has the strength to do that because no one within the party has the credibility to say, okay, we really know these people are not going to win. They can go to the side now. No, you're right. Nobody has the strength to do it. Although I don't really think Debbie Wasserman Schultz actually has any power. I think that was probably my guess is. She is probably working hand in glove with the Clinton campaign, and it's the Clinton campaign that is showing the power within the Democratic Party. There's no independent power base within the Republican Party at all, one way or the other, to be able to do that, whether it would be Bush maneuvering it, Rubio's not in a position to maneuver it, and they're not strong enough to do it themselves. But I don't really think Wasserman Schultz actually – I don't think she actually has the power to do that herself. I think it's the campaign that is helping her. That's just me.
Okay, well, that's a fair point to make. I didn't want to make this about her so much as a contrast between two different approaches to the job, but I really did want to focus it on Rance Priebus, who, again, it seems to me you're going now into your third debate. You know, set some limits. Not everybody in the country can run for president. And just because you've held elective office and you filed the paperwork doesn't mean you get to go on that stage over and over and over again.
And with that, I agree. And I don't think. And again, it's, you know, I use Wasserman Schultz's example because obviously she has power behind her. No, Prince, there are people who are behind Rince Priebus, but they don't have the power to move these people out. And you're right. Mm-hmm. That shows a weakness within the party.
So right. It'll be a good show Wednesday night. Good show. We'll see if Chris Christie gets any questions about getting thrown off the train. His chances are going down.
Well, maybe he can start the new movie, Throw the Governor from the Train.
All right, I think that's our show.
That's our show.
This was a good time. We'll answered most outstanding questions that America has had this week, I think. Pretty sure.
Even when we disagree, I learned so much from you guys, and I appreciate this show so much. So thank you.
Likewise.
All right, likewise.
So everybody, thank you again for listening. Go on out to moreperfectpodcast.com. Go like us on Facebook /moreperfectunionpodcast. Rate and review us on iTunes. And we'll see you again next week.
Thank you for listening to the More Perfect Union podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes and check out the website at moreperfectunionpodcast.com. If you have any questions or comments for the More Perfect Union podcast crew, you can email us at moreperfectunionpodcast@gmail.com. We'll talk to you next week.